I'll just read the paper. Recognized as the largest religious gathering in the world, the Kumbh Mela is a mammoth multi-faith event that hosts around 100 million pilgrims from diverse and at times antithetical Hindu traditions, ranging from polytheistic to monotheistic to atheist. Even a few Buddhist, Sikh, Jain, and other South Asian traditions also participate in the Kumbh, making it an intricately convoluted convergence of manifold beliefs, practices, and rituals. The enthusiasm of and differences among the millions of laypersons and ascetics who flock to the Kumbh occasionally culminate into a fierce commotion arising from mundane issues such as space allocation, crowd control, unchecked competition, and cross-commercialization. Despite embodying such a colossal chaos, the Kumbh Mela, I argue, provides an example of practical pluralism by effecting a mostly harmonious confluence of diverse belief systems and practices. Drawing from textual sources as well as my ethnographic fieldwork in the 2013 Mahakumbh Mela in Allahabad, India, this paper examines how the spirit of sacrifice embedded in the religious and cultural diversity of the Kumbh gives rise to active seeking of understanding across lines of differences. Although grounded in disparate theological, philosophical, and sociocultural foundations, millions of lay people, religious leaders, wandering sadhus, and ascetics coexist and coalesce, albeit temporarily, for 55 days. So this practical pluralism, how it emerges in this diversity, that's the main argument of my paper. And this practical pluralism is primarily affected by the collective sacrifice of I-ness and my-ness, that is ego and attachment, a sacrifice made for the larger good of the self and the society. The 2013 Kumbh Mela in Allahabad hosted over 130 million pilgrims for 55 days, starting from 14 January 2013, that's the day of the Makar Sankranti. On the Mauni Amavasya, then February 2013, and this is the biggest bathing day, probably the largest human gathering on a single day took place when over 30 million devotees and ascetics took holy dip in the confluence of two major rivers of India, the Ganga and the Yamuna, and they also call there is third river Saraswati, which is mythical or perhaps underground, whatever it is. The ephemeral Kumbh city that accommodated this millions of people spread over 20 square miles, which is bigger than whole of Oxford, which is around 17 square miles, the Oxford city. The sheer human achievement of creating such a temporary and yet complex infrastructure on the dry flood plains is astonishing, particularly with temporary roads, bridges, power stations, electricity, houses, tents to house millions of people, sanitary facilities, telecommunication, clinics, police and fire departments. As a participant observer of this gathering, I felt both overwhelmed and humbled. I felt humbled by the overwhelming experience of the immense spatial and spiritual vastness of this gathering, the intensity of religious rituals and devotions, the crudeness of material consumption. Of course, there is a lot of spiritual contemplation as well, but there was a lot of consumption of material. Like, you know, it was a very, you know, intricate balance or kind of conflicting thing with each other. So the crudeness of material consumption, and especially by the enthusiasm of millions of pilgrims and ascetics who flocked to the Kumbh with unwavering faith and intriguing spirit. In this colossal confluence of millions of people, lay pilgrims, religious practitioners, volunteers, and street vendors live together on the huge expanses of sandy river beds. They do like, what do they do practically? They bathe, dry clothes on the sand, perform rituals, meditate, walk the muddy roads, struggle with loads of luggage, shiver in woolen shawls, sit by dhunis, and this is what, dhunis are the fire pits where all these ascetics do. They do darshan of ascetics, seek their blessings, listen to discourses, relax under marquees, watch leelas. In the evening, there are all these religious performances, and in almost every encampment. So there is practically some more than 100 leelas or religious performances going at the same time. And their noise and everything, you know, they kind of mishmash each other. They buy, sell, donate, render voluntary services, and essentially become lost in the enormity of the event. These multifarious activities naturally raise questions about the core purpose and significance of this great gathering. What is this all about? Why do millions of people from diverse streams of faiths, beliefs, and cultures come to the Kumbh despite the hardships and challenges they face? What are the meanings of this great pilgrim fair for thousands of ascetics who encamp here for a month and pilgrims who come for a few days? How do they bury their differences and perform congenial pluralism? I asked these questions to about 40 sadhvis are female ascetics, religious leaders, volunteers, and laypersons. One of my informants, Baba Ram Puri, author of Autobiography of a Blue-Eyed Yogi. That's the book. Baba Ram Puri is actually an American expatriate, American citizen, and he is the first foreigner to be initiated as a sadhu in the oldest Juna Akhada tradition. That is the oldest sadhu tradition. And he was actually, he's the son of world-renowned pediatric surgeon, Dr. Stephen L. Kanz, who helped establish the field of pediatric surgery. He's one of the greatest innovators. So growing up in Beverly Hills, like among the famous and the rich, that's where he grew up, he became very critical of this culture of spectacle, what he calls culture of spectacle, and was trying to find out a kind of counterculture alternatives. So then he went to Harvard, he studied with Alan Watts and with Fritz Stahls, Berkeley, and then finally he traveled to India and became a sadhu. And for the last 40 years he's been living there, and now the Juna Akhada tradition has honored him as the Mahant, and he has got a permanent seat in the Juna Akhada Council. So Baba Ram Puri explains, quote, "This is Prayag." Now, Prayag is the original name of Allahabad. Allahabad was name given to that perhaps by Akbar, mostly by Akbar. "This is Prayag. Pra means pratham, pramukh, prachin, the first, foremost, and the original. And yag is yagna, the sacrifice. So Prayag, where we are sitting, is the foremost place of sacrifice. This is the best place to make sacrifice, and this is the best time to sacrifice, the most auspicious period. So if you make sacrifice in this period, then the fruits are much more than making it any other period. So the Kumbh is a macrocosm of sacrifice. In the microcosm, in the family, you have the same thing taking place. For example, the mother sacrifices her individualness and her self-interest to making the baby as fat as possible. Here in the ascetic community, we have the same thing. We also make sacrifice of our self-interest, of the myth of our individuality toward the collective interest, and we become one limb of the collective. So this is sacrifice," unquote. Thus, the Kumbh Mela is a great sacrifice comprising millions of personal sacrifices from day long and to lifelong. And literally, this is true. The Kumbh Mela is misted and mystified with the smoke rising from thousands of dhunis, which are personal sacred fire pits of mud or dirt around which hundreds of thousands of ascetics live day and night. Their fires are meant to represent both sacrificial pyres as well as funeral pyres. Although there is nothing visually striking about a dhuni burning in an earthen pit, the slow and steady smoldering of the wood constantly reminds the renouncers sitting around it to their ephemeral lives, which should be sacrificed for the larger good of others. So that's literally what sacrifice, or this is true. But drawing from Baba Rampuri's metaphor of sacrifice. I argue that the Kumbh Mela is a Mahayagna, a great sacrifice, effecting sacrifices of self-interest which include tangible things such as material possessions and objects of comfort, an intangible inclination toward familial bonds, personal differences, ego and the like. These tangible and intangible sacrifices made for the larger interest of society as well as the self could be classified in four categories, and these are the four categories that now the rest of the paper works on. The sacrifice of the personal wealth, personal comfort, social bond and differences. So the first, sacrifice of personal wealth. The Allahabad administration had sought a budget of Indian rupees 1.55 billion, which is I think around 200 million pounds, roughly like that, to conduct the 2013 Kumbh Mela spanning over 20 square miles and to build hundreds of bathing ghats, foot bridges, pontoon bridges for vehicles, temporary bus stands and all these things. However, this amount of money is nothing compared to the accumulative finances required to erect and run the temporary city of the Kumbh that comprises hundreds of large encampments constructed and maintained by traditional akhadas and religious organizations. Many of these encampments are spread over tens of acres of soft river bend, sand, and provide lodgings and boardings to thousands of ascetics and devotees. Thousands of pilgrims are fed free of cost, twice or thrice a day for 55 days. So these are like all these huge encampments. Most camps maintain huge canopies or marquees for organizing religious discourses, cultural performances or leelas. In the camps of many traditional akharas, such as the Juna Akhara, hundreds of thousands of sannyasis and sannyasinis burn hundreds of quintals of wood, we just saw the dhunis, to keep their dhunis smoldering 24/7. Who covers the expenses of the Kumbh Mela? In earlier times, it used to be the kings and queens. However, in recent times, wealthy patrons usually donate to the akharas and religious organizations to construct encampments which comprise makeshift accommodations, temples, assembly halls, performance areas, kitchens, drainage and sewage systems to maintain daily operations. Although many middle-class members affiliated with these institutions also make donations to their capacities, it is primarily the more wealthy members who contribute generously to support the participant religious organizations. Some patrons view it as their social responsibility, whereas most others support for religious reasons. In Hinduism, performing acts of charity has always been associated with yagna since the Vedic times. The word yagna is derived from the Sanskrit verb root yaj, which has a threefold meaning, namely, worshipping with sacrifice, uniting, and bestowing charity. The Kumbh Mela inspires thousands of such charitable acts on the part of wealthy patrons who might not otherwise be inclined to share their fortunes with others for non-religious reasons. Their sacrifices and philanthropic contributions help promote humanitarian tendencies. Many of these wealthy patrons also believe that by engaging in charitable giving, they earn religious merits while at the same time help the local community socially and economically. Ultimately, these charitable sacrifices make possible the running of the 55-day long event that facilitates the coexistence of millions of people. The Kumbh Mela nourishes their faith, rejuvenates their social bonding, helps foster a harmonious society. But moreover, the local economy is bolstered by the increase in monetary transactions that occur among thousands of small and big businesses, ranging from the construction of the temporary city to the many hawkers selling trinkets. Thus, the sacrifice of personal wealth for the Kumbh Mela, it helps both the donor as well as the society. That was the first thing. The second is sacrifice of personal comforts. Millions of pilgrims who faithfully flock to the Kumbh Mela with the hope of acquiring everlasting peace are usually greeted by dust, smoke, noise, the cold and chaos. As morning dawns over shimmering waters and sandy riverbeds, thousands of shivering pilgrims emerge from tattered tents and thatched huts to perform rituals and to seek wisdom from the multitude of sadhus. They must make their way over the overcrowded, muddy makeshift roads made of unevenly laid steel plates in order to reach the confluence, bathe in the spine-chilling water of freezing temperature, change clothes outdoors, and when required, use one of the 35,000 portable toilets of this huge pop-up megacity. At this sacred carnival, along with the sanctity of the atmosphere, millions of participants also inhale the fine sandy particles of ashy smoke. The hardships and adversities of the Kumbh Mela for the pilgrims are multiplied many times over for the Kalpavasis. And these are the Kalpavasis spiritual aspirants who spend an entire month at the Kumbh Mela in prayers, meditation and satsang. They lead an austere and devout lifestyle. During the Hindu month of Magh, the Kalpavasis temporarily leave their families, stay in the flimsy tents with no heating, follow a vow of celibacy, abstain from enjoying worldly pleasures, eat non-spicy vegetarian food once a day, and try to live an ascetic life of renunciation and devotion. The Kalpavasis rise before dawn, immerse themselves twice daily in the icy water of the confluence, listen to spiritual discourses, participate in religious rituals, and do satsang for the rest of the day. Many other adherents of the Kumbh lead a similarly Spartan arduous life as volunteers in the camps of religious organizations. They help in camps' daily operations, rendering humanitarian services or attending religious conventions. What do they receive in return? Why do an estimated 2.5 million Kalpavasis and millions of pilgrims willingly sacrifice personal comforts and endure hardships at the Kumbh Mela? While most of the replies I received could be summed up into the phrases, like the most common phrase is to attain moksha, attain liberation. Or, you know, there are also like live a successful, prosperous life. But few responses were strikingly divergent. For instance, a volunteer at the camp of Swami Chidananda Muniji's related, quote, "Here I learn how to live with others, understand their viewpoints and make adjustments so that we can work together cooperatively. We also help society. We go out every day to clean the riverfront and participate in other drives to preserve our environment," unquote. Laura, a Kalpavasi from Denver in the camp of Saima Mataji, said, quote, "60 of us from all over the world are staying here throughout the Kumbh Mela to learn the lessons of how to dissolve our ego," unquote. Nalini, a volunteer at Swami Avadheshananda Giriji's camp, came up with an interesting observation, quote, "We need to practice how to be fully attached and at the same time fully detached. We spent weeks enthusiastically erecting the whole camp to find details. Then we spent almost 2 months running it successfully, and then we will need to dismantle and level everything with total detachment. Here we practice how to live with equanimity in this perishable world," unquote. These viewpoints resonate well with a study funded by the UK-based Economic and Social Research Council and conducted by scholars Stephen Richer, Nick Hopkins, Narayan Srinivas, and others from 5 universities, including 4 from the UK and Allahabad University, India. After an extensive study of the annual Magh Mela at Allahabad, like, and every 6 years it becomes the Kumbh Mela, every 4 years it becomes the Kumbh Mela, they assert that although the Mela incorporates almost every imaginable form of urban blight, which could engender stress, irritation, tension between people, the Mela functions smoothly. And here is a rather long citation from the report. Quote, "We have been studying the Mela for 6 years now, using a range of methods from surveys to ethnographies to experiments. And it seems that, far from being stressed, people talk of their experience in powerfully positive terms. What is more, these effects seem to endure well beyond the event itself. The results of our survey show that, compared with a control group of people not attending the festival, Kalpavasis' well-being was better after the Mela than before. How can this be? Our analysis suggests that the starting point lies in the development of a shared identity. Kalpavasis come to see themselves and others at the festival as a group, as us rather than me and you. This makes social interaction smoother and social relations more rewarding. The fact that Kalpavasis share common goals make them more likely to understand and respect the perspective of others and, crucially, to work together in order to achieve those goals. Kalpavasis give space for others to perform their devotions, and this combination of intimate social relations and ability to live out the aspirations rooted in one's group identity, what they call collective self-realization, are critical to the extreme positivity that Kalpavasis experience during the Mela. Unquote. What this work demonstrates then is the power of identity in transforming collecting experience and the power of collecting experience in transforming everyday life. It shows how a sense of shared identity provides the underpinning for that sense of community and civility. And perhaps most remarkably, it suggests that shared identity also improves an individual's physical and psychological well-being, with symptoms of stress less apparent after the Mela than before. Based on my ethnographic fieldwork, I strongly concur with this observation that despite the hardships such as extreme cold, crowding, chaos, cacophony, and a minimally basic physical infrastructure to endure for almost 2 months, most Kalpavasis, pilgrims and volunteers at the Kumbh Mela return home with a better sense of well-being. Although they may not know or be able to articulate what exactly they get out of the Kumbh Mela, most of them return with a positive experience, one so meaningful that it draws many of them back to the Kumbh Mela year after year. Almost 130 years ago, Mark Twain also observed the same in the 1895 Kumbh Mela. Quote, "These pilgrims had come from all over India, and some of them had been months on the way, plodding patiently along in the heat and dust, worn, poor, hungry, but supported and sustained by an unwavering faith and belief. It is wonderful, the power of a faith like that, that can make multitudes upon multitudes of the old and weak and the young and the frail enter without hesitation or complaint upon such incredible journeys and endure resultant miseries without repining. It is done in love or it is done in fear. I don't know what it is. No matter what the impulse is, the act born of it is beyond imagination, marvelous to our kind of people, the cold whites." End quote. Historically, the first written evidence of the Kumbh Mela can be found in the account of Chinese monk Yuan Sheng, who visited India in 629 to 645 CE. However, there are references to the Hindu river Melas in the Buddhist text around 400 BCE and in the reports of Greek ambassadors to the court of Chandragupta Maurya around 300 BCE. There is historical evidence that the tradition of the Kumbh Mela has lasted for hundreds, if not thousands of years, without any planned publicity campaign. And this, of course, started at the beginning of the 20th century. And it has continued to draw increasingly more and more people every time. What lies behind the perennial sustainability of this tradition? Sadhu Vivek Jivandas explains, quote, "Only those traditions last which deliver. Those traditions which fail to deliver slowly dissipate and disappear. It's like tissue rejection. Anything that is forced upon will soon be rejected. Anything that is required and perhaps will soon be inherited and will always remain." Unquote. So this is about like the sacrifice of personal comfort for millions of pilgrims and Kalpavasis and how, you know, they endure that and what they get out of that. And finally, the sacrifice of the personal bonds. While the Kalpavasis and pilgrims of the Kumbh renounce personal comforts for a few weeks, the hundreds of thousands of ascetics who throng the Kumbh renounce Not only personal comforts, but also personal properties, familial bonds, and communal connections for a lifetime. For thousands of years, ascetics have wandered the sacred geography of India, from the high Himalayas to the southern seashores, from the populated plains to the dense forests, in pursuit of otherworldly and also sometimes thisworldly ends. For example, around 2000 years ago, Alexander the Great encountered 10 Hindu Naga sadhus, and Baba Rampur comes in that tradition of Naga sannyasis, who pursued asceticism to the point of regarding food and clothing as detrimental to purity of thought. Alexander's conversation with the sadhus, and it's very interesting conversations, the way he asked questions and the answers. So this conversation is recorded by Plutarch in the 1st century CE and also in the Alexander Dendamis colloquy, in which the Greeks refer to these sadhus as gymnosophists, naked philosophers. Alexander was so impressed by their philosophy that he requested one of the sadhus, Kalyan, whom the Greeks then named Kalanas, to join him back to Greece. So he went with him to Greece and then remained his lifetime guru. There are many vernacular terms to describe ascetics or renouncers: sadhus, yogis, babas, bavas, sannyasis, munis, and the like. Although each category is loaded with different theological, philosophical, and ideological nuances, and innumerable variations in their practices, rituals, and attires, the common thread is to renounce personal bonds, which occur in different forms and varying degrees. The goal of the Hindu ascetic has been to acquire unusual temporal skills or abilities, siddhis as they call it, to experience imperturbable tranquility or to attain the blissful beatitude in the state of liberation, moksha. In the Kumbh Melas, thousands of spiritual aspirants renounce their family ties and are initiated as ascetics in the Hindu tradition of traditional akhadas. And this is from Juna Akhada. This is where, you know, they get all those spiritual aspirants, they come together, and then the final initiation ceremony happens in the Kumbh Mela. The ancient and sacred text of the Bhagavad Gita, one of India's prime religious texts, informs that most Hindu renouncers practice one of the four yogas: Karma Yoga, that is yoga of action; Jnana Yoga, knowledge; Bhakti Yoga, devotion; or Dhyana Yoga, yoga of meditation. The word yoga, which broadly denotes the mental and physical disciplines that spiritual aspirants practice, is derived from the Sanskrit verb root yuj, which means to unite or to join. The ultimate goal of most renouncers, many of whom are also called yogis, is to unite with the divine. However, Sandra Hausner here, she argues, quote, "Ironically, the fusion with the divine is only possible through fission, or by breaking apart from the trap of material reality with its seeming social and physical laws of differentiation," unquote. The physical, social, psychological worlds of these renouncers are often symbolized by metaphors of sacrifice. As explained earlier, most renouncers of these akharas live around dhunis, which are personal sacred fire pits of mud or dirt, which physically symbolize the continual sacrifice they need to make in order to achieve their goals. Based upon her conversation, Sandra's conversation with many renouncers, Hausner explains that a proper dhuni includes all five essential elements of universe. According to Hindu sacred literature, it's the element of earth, water, fire, air, and space. The mud of the fire pit represents earth. The water kept, and here is the water pot, the water kept in a small pot by the pit represents water. The mantras recited by the nearby sadhus represent air. And the fifth element of space pervades and sustains the four other elements. This outer world represented by a dhuni is equivalent to both the outer physical body of the renouncer sitting next to it and to his or her inner psychological body, both of which are supposed to be burnt one day and turn into ashes. The Does the sacrifice of thousands of dhunis at the Kumbh Mela represent the macrocosm and microcosm of Hindu renouncers? The ash produced by the fire, known as vibhuti or bhasma, signifies how all material substance is reduced to the same grey dust one day. It reminds the renouncers as well as others of the impermanence of all material forms. The fire at a dhuni keeps a renouncer's sacrifice alive by reminding him to break off from the outer world of social relations and material gratifications, as well as from the inner world of thoughts and cognitions, the fission with which mundane required for the fusion with the divine. What do ascetics do at the Kumbh Mela? Apart from the ritualistic bathing and public blessing for which they are famous, they in fact pursue their spiritual endeavors in a myriad of ways. Sri Sri Ravi Shankarji explains, quote, "There are various methods and ways of worshipping in the Hindu tradition. Some do satsang, some simply sit with the dhuni. Some sit in vairagya, that is total dispassion. Some just bless. And some just don't do anything. They are just there. It is like a spiritual expo. Everybody is free to find their own way, their own path. Everybody is free to explore their way into spirituality. And an explorer doesn't say that this is right and that is wrong. He just wants to experiment with his life, experiment with truth. And in the process of experimentation, you may do many wrong things as well as learn from that. This is beauty of Hinduism, which is basically liberal. It doesn't say that you have to believe in this book or that one thing. It gives individual freedom of thinking, freedom of practicing rituals the way you would like to do it. So it is inherent characteristic of Hinduism." Unquote. Thus, the Kumbh facilitates the coming together of ascetics, scholars, practitioners, and pilgrims from diverse traditions. Most participate in discourses, discussions, and reflections, and meditations with positive intention of elevating the self and benefiting society. People cannot visit all the different places ascetics and scholars come from, but they can all converge in one place to share their thoughts and experiences and learn from one another. And finally, the sacrifice of differences. One meaning of the word sacrifice in the Oxford English Dictionary is, quote, "an act of giving up something valued for the sake of something else regarded as more important or worthy," unquote. Nonetheless, it takes a conscious effort for many of us to let go, to sacrifice our personal opinions, beliefs, and differences even for the larger good of society. Renouncers at the Kumbh Mela are no exception to this innate human tendency to reject differences. Factional feuds among the order of ascetics come up occasionally at the Kumbh Mela on the issues such as which Akhara ascetics will be the first to do the Shahi Snan, and Shahi Snan is the ritual of bathing on the most auspicious days. Sometimes an akhara threatens to boycott the Shahi Snan if it is not allowed to take place in the ritual bathing in a certain order, at a certain place, or a certain time. Kama McLean refers to an unpublished study on the 1998 Haridwar Kumbh Mela by Jack Llewellyn, in which he reports a discordant impasse between the Juna akhara and the Mela administrations. However, 3 years later, at the 2001 Kumbh Mela at Allahabad, the Mela administration and Akharas reached a historical agreement in deciding the sequencing and timing of the Shahi Snan, which replaced the earlier agreement made in 1906 by the British. Hailing it as one of the most significant achievements of the Kumbh Mela, Jayesh Mishra notes, quote, "the mutual respect, understanding and the overwhelming sense of accommodation on both the sides shall be regarded as the most important milestone in the management of the Kumbh Mela of the new millennium," unquote. The fact that there is disagreement at one front of the Kumbh Mela does not necessarily discard the possibility that there will be concordance at other levels. Occasional inter- and intra-Akhara conflicts or disputes between the Akharas and the administration may be disruptive, but considering the demographical, spatial, conceptual, and ideological vastness of the coup, conflicts are bound to pop up at times. Nevertheless, they do not diminish the existence of commonality that might provide the basis for religious, social, and communal harmony. One common belief among many pilgrims is that the divine potency of the confluence of the three rivers is so redemptive that regardless of one's imperfections, just bathing here and being here during the auspicious time bestows moksha in this lifetime. So there are many such common beliefs. Another belief is, like most religious discourses, stresses the common Hindu ideology that all living beings, or philosophy, all living beings are essentially Atmans, which pervades the body and experiences. Although many such similarities bind the ascetics and pilgrims through unifying threads, they do need to resolve their essential differences at various levels in order to live together even for 55 days. Baba Rampuri of Juna Akhada illustrates many such examples in which theological and ideological differences have been dissolved. The Juna Akhada, one of the largest Akharas with an estimate of around 400,000 ascetics, is divided into 52 Madhis, and each Madhi is kind of a subgroup or a lineage. And this Madhis, this 52 Madhis of Juna Akhada are like kind of spread all over India. Although the Juna Akhada is fundamentally a Shaivite tradition established by Adi Shankaracharya, the common first guru and Isht Deva, it's like the cherished divinity, of all 52 Madhi is Guru Dattatreya, who is regarded as an avatar of Lord Vishnu. Hence, the ascetics of the Juna Akhada who worship Shiva greet each other with Om Namo Narayan, like or hail to like Narayan. Om Namo Narayan, which is the name of Lord Vishnu, even if they worship Lord Shiva. Moreover, the top administrative body of the Akhara, as well as each Madhi, is called Shri Pancha, the body of fire, representing the theologically disparate traditions of Brahma, Vishnu, Shiva, Shakti, and Ganesh. The Juna Akhara tradition has not only embraced theologically diverse Hindu deities and gurus, but also accommodated Buddhists and Muslims within their traditions and exalted them as the head of their Madhis. Like literally there are Muslim Sufis who have become the head of the Madhi, or a Buddhist who has become the head of the Madhi. One of the 52 Madhis of the Juna Akhara is called the Lama Madhi because it was established by a sage guru, Padmasambhav, who was also known as Guru Rinpoche or the precious guru, or Lopan Rinpoche in that thing. Padmasambhava was instrumental in transmitting Vajrayana Buddhism to Tibet, Bhutan, and other neighboring countries, and is considered an emanation of Buddha Amitabha. Recognizing the Juna Akhara still comprises a Madhi associated with the Vajrayana Buddhism tradition as an integral part of it, the Dalai Lama often visits the Juna Akhara during the Kumbh Mela. Almost every Kumbh Mela or the major Mahakumbh Mela, Dalai Lama comes, and he kind of, you know, rejuvenate this ties with Juna Akhara. Baba Rampuri further informed that the Madhi to which he belongs to is known as the Multani Madhi of the Juna Akhara. It is called Multani Madhi because it was established by a Hindu sage, Khem Sufi saint, called Multani Baba, who was also known by Hindus as Keshavpuri and by Muslims as Pir Shah Samsh-e-Tabriz, that is the guru of the Rumi. The tomb of Multani Baba is located just outside the city of Multan, Pakistan, with which its name is connected. Multani Baba had both Hindus as well as Muslim disciples. He had written books on both Sufi ideology as well as Hindu theology of the 10 avatars, 10 incarnations of God. When he left his body, he gave instructions that he be interred in a traditional Hindu sannyasi way, sitting in a meditative posture in an underground cave with a mala in hand, but a kabra, a Muslim grave, even if empty, should be built just next to the samadhi. So there is this samadhi, and next to it is the kabra. Similarly, three Udasin Akhadas, comprised of Sikh following, Guru Nanak and worshipping Guru Granth Sahib, are also an integral part of the traditional Hindu Akhadas present at the Kumbh Mela. Thus, the Kumbh Mela facilitates the coexistence of manifold diverse traditions, and I'm not going into the Jain descriptions here, diverse traditions that have partially sacrificed their theological, ideological, cultural and social differences in order to harmoniously engage with diversity and to actively seek understanding across lines of differences. Religious teachers from heterogeneous traditions converge in this multicultural, multi-faith event with their own set of perspectives, purposes, and prejudices. While they share the same space with religious others, many of them also share sentiments of mutual acceptance and assimilation, and thereby impart the spirit of pluralism through their discourses at the Kumbh Mela. For example, many religious leaders whom I interviewed at the Kumbh Mela expressed one common theme, and that is that the Kumbh is a place where one should learn to get rid of one's ego. Ego, I-ness and my-ness, is the root cause of most problems. Arrogance, differences, intolerance, fears, jealousy, pressures, etc. And the external problems that arise as a result of the ego. So this was like a repeated discourse and I attended, I don't know, more than 50 different discourses, met different leaders. And this would come up immediately, like, you know, get rid of ego, get rid of I-ness, my-ness, believe yourself as an Atman. But then I asked the question, like, how does the Kumbh help one eliminate or at least subside one's ego? Sadhu Brahma Vihari Das explains, quote, "The Kumbh is an overwhelming experience, such an overwhelming experience that makes a person humble. Even the spiritual leaders who come to the Kumbh, and they may have a great ashram, which is permanent, but on a temporary basis, everybody is on the same playing field. Even the spiritual leaders and gurus who come to the Kumbh, they realize that I am not the only one. There are thousands out there who are leading the masses. Whether they say it or not, in their heart, they have to accept it. Before the grandeur of the Ganga and Yamuna, in the eternity, in the sand of time, before the cosmic forces, everybody on the earth is on the same level. And he also accepts that other people are doing good work. He has to accept it. So even the spiritual leaders are humbled, which is very important for any leader. Even the followers are humbled when they see thousands and millions of other followers. So this gathering, which humbles both the devotees and the spiritual leaders before the energy of God, itself leads to harmony. Ego leads to disharmony and humility leads to harmony." Unquote. And finally, the conclusion. Okay, just quickly finish this. Okay, at the Kumbh Mela, against the backdrop of many Indian traditions converging for one event, one is able to gain insight into the unique expressions of India's diversity of populations, traditions, faiths and practices. Moreover, one is able to explore what this coming together event really means to religious authorities and how its significance is conveyed to their devotees. Their diverse teachings and discourses could polarize Indian society. However, they also provide a plethora of opportunities to discuss, debate, examine, clarify, and strengthen the participants' own place in this richly diverse world of differences. Along with these differences, the spiritual and the commercial commingle at the Kumbh, when all senses are overloaded by this massive religious gathering. This experience humbles both religious leaders and pilgrims to varying degrees. So the Kumbh Mela is a confluence of sacrifices, a Mahayagna or a great sacrifice, the sacrifice of personal wealth, personal comfort, social bonds and the differences, and most importantly, the I-ness and my-ness, which is very nicely summarized by Sri Ramana Maharshi. He says, quote, "By whatever path you go, you will have to lose yourself in the One. Surrender is complete only when you reach the stage, Thou art all and Thy will be done. Thank you.